couple things as we get started this morning. I don't know if you had a chance to check your email this morning, but if you did, you may have seen that Lori Schneider's father, Joe Stockdale, passed away late last night. And so I would just ask that you keep Lori and the family in prayer. We don't know arrangements yet as far as that goes. And then I also learned that we have a birthday here this morning, that Roland Jennings has turned 28 years old. Is that what it is? 28. It was closer to like 1928. It was 1930 or so, I think, when Roland was born. It's fascinating when you look at how many things have developed since Roland was born. You know, obviously the Model T was in existence before he was born, but you think of that when Roland was born, that was right around when the Model T was at its most popular, 28, 29. It's just a fascinating thing to think of what Roland has lived through, including when I shared this at Ruby's Pantry here this last week, including the incredible fight in 1994. Do you remember this? When George Foreman came out of 20 years of retirement to fight against a 26-year-old world champion and beat him at the age of 45. I mean, isn't that incredible? I mean, think of it. It gives me hope because here I am at 42. You know, I could come out of retirement at any time and go and do some of the stuff that I did when I was in high school and early college, and then I probably wouldn't ever walk again. It's really how it would probably play out. But it's an incredible thing. What was fascinating about that, I remember that happening. I was a senior in high school at the time, and I remember thinking, oh, that's interesting. I had no idea. Really, couldn't really put any kind of concept to this fact of George Foreman being 45 years old at the time, doing what he did. I was just like, seriously? Now that I'm 42, I have a lot more appreciation for what that man did at the age of 45. And to be a guy who was 26, you know, in the world, it's really fascinating. But I can't help but think that even though people knew who George Foreman was, they must have thought somehow along the line, this guy is nobody. At the age of 45, he's got nothing to really be able to stand against a 26-year-old in the prime of his fighting career, and yet he did. And it points a little bit to what we'll see here this morning. And if you read the email that I sent off yesterday, and also as a senior in high school, and I remember this so well because as I was on the wrestling team, I'm not coming out of retirement. I'm not going to go wrestle again. I did that once in 2008. I went to an old-timers tournament. That was a horrible idea. Absolutely horrible idea. I felt like my lungs had turned inside out. I'm pretty sure I was breathing blood is what it felt like. Just nasty. Anyway, when I was a senior in high school, we had a lightweight. I don't remember some of the details. I know I said in the emails 103 pounds, might have been 112. It doesn't really make a difference. But one of these light guys, our guy was a sophomore, and he was a very good wrestler. You know, and so much so, in fact, that he was seeded number one in the tournament. And it was a Little Falls tournament. I was, you know, obviously in Wadena at the time. I had no idea that I'd be living here for my career. But it's this amazing story where the sophomore, top seeded in his bracket, and he gets this little seventh grader. You know, his first round, he gets a seventh grader, and this, you have to understand this wrestler that we had. I mean, if you didn't believe that he was the greatest, he would convince you that he's the greatest wrestler that has ever walked the face of the earth. You know, that's partially why he was so good. He had this aura about him. He kind of carried this confidence. That's a polite way to say cocky and arrogant, you know. But that's the way he was, and so no one could touch him. And so he steps out on this mat, one of the first matches of the tournament, and here comes this little lowly seventh grader, and this seventh grader just destroyed him. I mean, absolutely, nobody knew. Everyone looking at us like, who is this guy, this seventh grader? And the name was Luke Becker, and I wrote this in the email. And if you know anything about Minnesota wrestling, you then know that this lowly seventh grader eventually turned into a three-time state champion and a four-time NCAA All-American, one-time national champion, and helped lead the Gophers to two consecutive national championships. I mean, it's like, oh, that guy. You know, and there was just once you kind of put into this idea of who this guy really is, then it kind of made sense. But at the time, nobody knew anything. I mean, who is this guy? This is a little seventh grader. And that's what we're going to see here this morning. As Jesus has just finished up this time that he's had in this upper room with his disciples, chapter 17 was all this high priestly prayer. And what's fascinating is that this high priestly prayer, Jesus is praying as that high priest. And in a couple weeks, we're going to see it as he's on trial. And he's going to be on trial in front of who? The high priest. And it's just this amazing contrast between here you have the high priest going basically, you know, putting on trial the true high priest. It's just what a clash. And yet here's Jesus, and we're going to see some of the same stuff we talk about today in a couple weeks in regards to that, because in the midst of that, Jesus is totally in control of all of it. And so what we were doing is we looked through this whole upper room experience. Okay, starting roughly in John chapter 12, Jesus washes his disciples' feet. John chapter 13, he says he showed the full extent of his love, washed his feet, and said, what I have done for you, now you are to go and do to other people. In other words, when you love one another, you will demonstrate this love. You'll demonstrate, you'll point back to me, and that people will know that you're my followers by the way that you choose to love each other. And then we went through all these instructions. He gave this kind of this last dissertation all to his disciples saying, don't miss this, guys. This is the last time that I really have this opportunity to talk to you, and give this lengthy talk to them. And he closes with this relatively long prayer starting in John chapter 17. We just finished it up last week. And he prays for himself. He prays for his disciples, and he prays for us. And it's just this amazing thing. He's praying for unity. He's praying that this gospel will go forth, that we can be, in the sense, that salt and that light. And what we come to now today is that prayer is done. And as we step into it, we're going to see Jesus is leaving Jerusalem. He's going to go across. We're going to see it. He's going to go across this Kidron Valley. We'll talk a little bit about that. And he's going to go up to this garden that was he oftentimes spent his time in. He frequented this garden. He would have been known to be in this area frequently. And that would have been times that he was interacting with his disciples. But even more so, I think it was time for him to reflect and to pray. And then what we're going to see is he's going to be arrested. And just pay attention and watch as we work through this scripture who's really in control when it comes to this idea of this arrest. So as we get started here, here's where we start in John chapter 18. So we just stepped out of that high priestly prayer, and this is where we encounter in John chapter 18, and this is how it starts. He says, when he, this is Jesus, had finished praying, Jesus left with his disciples, and he crossed the Kidron Valley. On the other side, there was a garden, and he and his disciples went into it. So we understand from other gospel accounts that this garden that's being referred to is actually the Garden of Gethsemane. And Gethsemane means basically oil press. In other words, it was the idea that they would press out the olives. And I just, is there a context here? Is there a parallel? Maybe. In the sense that even in the midst of this, Jesus, in a sense, is being pressed. And we're going to see that in Matthew 26 as we look at that a little bit here this morning as well. There's this incredible weight that Jesus is bearing with him as he's crossing now this valley, heading up to this Garden of Gethsemane. And you watch his posture. You watch what he does. You watch what he bears. And yet, even in the midst of what he bears, he is still totally in control. I mean, it's just fascinating. And so as we wrestle with this, I want to ask you, start reflecting a little bit, even now, what is it that really weighs at you? You know, where is the chaos in your life right now? Because even in the midst of those chaotic times and that chaos that we experience, I'm convinced that the Lord wants us to understand his control in the midst of our chaos. So here's what we have. Let's look at this here. This gives you a picture of Jerusalem. All right, right here. This is the temple. And there's some different ideas and theories, but notice this is the house of Caiaphas. This is the palace of Herod. And then we would have, I believe, Annas' house. We'll see that in a couple weeks, is up in this area here. It's believed for the most part that this Last Supper took place somewhere down in this area of Jerusalem. And so what happens is, what we read in here in John chapter 18, verse 1, is Jesus now leaves and heads out here to Gethsemane. This is the Mount of Olives. And interesting to note, remember this path here? Okay, Bethany and Jericho. This is that road. As they're coming down that mountain, we talked about this a number of months ago. As Jesus and all of his disciples, as well as all these people who saw Jesus raise Lazarus from the dead, are coming down to Jerusalem, this is the road that they would have taken. So going down that Mount of Olives, in a sense, towards Jerusalem, this is when that triumphal entry took place, and people started throwing their coats down, and here comes Jesus, here comes all these people, and the Jewish leaders have been looking out and saying, we got trouble. This is a big deal. This is a problem. And remember, this only happened less than a week ago. In the context of what we're looking at the scriptures, this was only a week ago that Jesus had just entered into Jerusalem triumphantly. It feels like a long time for us because we've been dealing with it so long in the scriptures. But so just recently, Jesus had walked down this road coming into the temple area, and people are celebrating him. And so now Jesus is going back. He's heading out this way, crossing the Kidron Valley up to Gethsemane. What's interesting with this Kidron Valley, it basically means winter flowing. So the water would only flow during the rainy season, which was in winter. Otherwise, it was fairly dry and you could walk across it. But in the winter, that water would flow pretty extensively because that was the rainy season. And you look at how close it is to the temple, and some of the commentaries would even refer to this hillside here, because of its proximity to the temple, and I don't remember where they would dispose of the excess from the sacrifices, but they said it wouldn't be surprising that this valley here, this whole side, would be covered in blood, dried blood, and wouldn't be washed away until that rainy season, that winter season. So even in the midst of this, what Jesus was walking across, just parallels and pictures of what he's about to experience. He's the only one, I think, that really knows and understands what he's going to experience. But yeah, even as he's walking across that, what dynamic picturing we have of this whole sequence of who Jesus is, what he's about to do for us. And it's just like, there's really no response that you have except for just dropping your jaw going, what in the world? So here's what we have then. What's also interesting about this Kidron Valley, this is the same valley that you read about in the book of 2 Samuel, when David is fleeing from his betrayer. If you remember, he had this counselor, he had this advisor for him, Ahithophel was his name. And what's interesting is he had a son, Absalom, who was basically trying to have this conspiracy against King David and kind of drive King David out. Well, Ahithophel, that's a really difficult name to say, he was King David's advisor. And what ended up happening is Ahithophel, who was a close friend of David, actually turned on David and started advising Absalom and telling Absalom what he should do. And so David ended up having to flee because his close advisor betrayed him, his friend betrayed him. And then Ahithophel even said to Absalom, oh, now that King David's gone, you know what you ought to do? You ought to take his wives and his concubines and take them up on the roof, you know, and have sexual relations with them. And it's just a disaster. Well, what came to happen then is, catch the parallel here. David's betrayer, Ahithophel, and David fled going up the Mount of Olives, okay? His betrayer ended up being so guilt-stricken that he actually hung himself. And we see the same thing happen with Jesus' betrayer in Judas. It's the only two times in the scriptures that you have a reference for someone actually hanging themselves. And both times, it was a friend, one of King David and one of Jesus. And we look at throughout this process of who Jesus is. You know, and oftentimes they're looking at, we want another king like David to be our Messiah. And so when Jesus enters, like we talked about, coming down from the Mount of Olives, I mean, what a better picture of this new King David. Here he comes. Let's throw the palms down. Let's throw the coats down. This is it. This is the time. And yet Jesus doesn't give them that. And yet how close was he to this new king? I mean, much closer than we really gave credit for. And what's just amazing about it, we look at David as a man after God's own heart. And here you have Jesus, who literally has God's own heart. You know, what an amazing picture. And so we have, in a sense, this King David on a much higher level than anyone ever really grasped. And maybe that's why we missed it. So that's just some of the interesting stuff. Gives you a little bit of a picture as to what we're looking at. Here's one more picture. Gives you a little bit of a profile look. So this is that valley right here. This is the Kidron Valley. And it's believed that Jesus here would have walked with his disciples. They would have crossed a cross right around in here and gone up to, this is the garden, this is the Mount of Olives. So they're in that garden, not up on the top of the mountain, but down in the side. And gives you a little bit of a picture. So here's Jesus, very well known to be placed, good view of the temple. And we're going to see what's going to happen here now. And so Matthew's account. So Matthew has this account that John omits, and so I want to touch on it a little bit. We won't look at it extensively, but there's a part of the story that I think is important because it helps us give a little bit of a setting. So here's Jesus at the Garden of Gethsemane, and it says now in Matthew 26 that Jesus went with his disciples to a place called Gethsemane. This is where he crossed the Kidron Valley. John just had that phrase, but phrased a little bit differently. And he said to them, sit here while I go over here and pray. All right, so Jesus had just prayed with them. He had prayed for himself, he had prayed for the disciples, and he had prayed for all those who will believe. And then they cross the valley and says, guys, I got to go pray. I was like, man, Jesus, how much praying do you have to do in a day? You know, you just did this, and it's getting late. The time would have been probably around 11 o'clock, maybe even up to 12 o'clock, but in that ballpark area. So Jesus literally has hours left, 16 hours maybe left of his life. Jesus knows it. No one else really knows and has the concept there. And so watch what happens now. And so then he said to them, my soul. So he's walking to the garden. He pulls James and John and Peter to go up farther with him. And this is what he says to him. He says, my soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. I am so consumed with anxiety. I am just wrecked. I'm in such turmoil. I'm in despair. These are all, I think, real words. We have to remember and understand, yes, Jesus is God, but it also says that Jesus endured all temptations. Everything that you have been tempted to, Jesus has dealt with. He has experienced that. And yet he was without sin, is what the scripture says. And so this is all of that weight. And you can imagine this heavy weight that he's experiencing. He says, my soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. He says, stay here and keep watch with me. And then watch what he does. Going a little farther, Jesus falls on his face to the ground and he prays. You remember the Egyptian ruler, Anwar Sadat. It says that his prayer posture, you know, he had actually had a callus on his forehead because his prayer posture was, in a sense, on his knees face down, and his face was so oftentimes on the ground that he formed a callus. And that's this posture that we're seeing Jesus, where literally he falls to his knees, he gets his head down on the ground. And it's interesting because this is a contrast to what we saw in John 17. What was his posture in John 17, remember? It said he looked up to heaven. He did the same thing when he rose Lazarus from the grave. He looked up to heaven. This is a totally different posture. And I'm convinced that this posture has a lot to do with what Jesus is experiencing right now, where it's just like, oh God. Falls to his knees, falls on his face, and says, I am in desperate need of you right now. And this is what he prays. He fell on his face on the ground and he prayed, my Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me. Yet not as I will, but as you will. And what's interesting, if you look at this idea of this cup, you see it from time to time through the scriptures, but in we'll say Job chapter 21, verse 20. I think I marked it here. Whenever you see all throughout the scriptures, there's this idea of this cup. And so this is what it says in Job. And Job at this time is replying back to God. If you're familiar with the story of Job, Job lost everything. Talk about turmoil, okay? Talk about anxiety. Talk about depravity and all of this, you know, stuff that he'd be experiencing, this inner turmoil. Here would be Job possibly in the same posture, on his knees, on his face, crying out to God. And this is one of the things that Job says in this context. He says, it is said God stores up a man's punishment for his sons. In other words, there's this wrath that exists. God's the one that's the righteous judge. He's the one that gets to judge it. He says, let him repay the man himself so that he will know it. And then it says this in verse 20. Let his own eyes see his destruction. Let him drink of the wrath of the Almighty. So whenever you see this idea of this cup as so closely tied with God's wrath, and we don't oftentimes like to talk about God's wrath, but what we're seeing here is what Jesus is saying is, Lord, I don't want to. I don't want to drink the cup of your wrath. So I decided to, we're going to call this maybe the blender series, okay? All right, here we go. Because it was so much fun last week. Everyone wanted to try it, and so we'll let everyone try it here this week too, okay? So here was what we have. This is idea, that this is reality. As Jesus is really in this turmoil, okay, we got to understand what's causing the turmoil. Is it just this death that he's about to experience? I don't think so. That's probably a very real part of it. I'm not diminishing that. Is it the suffering that he's going to take on? Yes, I think that that's part of it, but I think there's so much more to it than that. He's going to be abused. He's going to be crushed. He's going to be pulverized, really. He's going to have his skin ripped open. He's going to hang on a cross and he's going to suffer, and he's got to do this in about 16 hours from now. You know, and it's all be said and done by that time. He'll suffer even hours before that. But there's more to it, I'm convinced in that. And so what we look at is things like a donut, like donuts, right? National Donut Day was Friday. Did anyone go get a free donut? Wow, that's it? They had free donuts at the bakery, and we, all six of us, went and got a free donut. I felt a little bit guilty, saying, well, what can I get for you? Six free donuts, please. That was it, okay? But I got over it, okay? This is not it. This is a different one. This is a little old. Okay. This is leftover from National Donut Day. Anyway, but here's the idea. We like donuts, right? Okay, they taste good, but we also know what donuts do to us, right? They like to stick to your thighs, right? And maybe your rib cage a little bit more than you'd like to, okay? So here's the reality. We know that there's this temptation to eat the donut, okay? But I know I shouldn't, but I will. It's this idea of temptation, okay? There's going to be cause and effects. If I eat the donut, I'm going to feel the effects of it. You know, there's consequences for the sins that we do. Cookies. You know, I used to eat Chips Ahoy by the sleeve. You know, they're so good. You know, there's got to be something more than just sugar, chocolate, and stuff in there. There's got to be some form of an actual drug because they are so addicting. Am I right? Okay. You know, and then there's also candy bars, all right? I don't know what your weakness is or what you have, but, you know, you throw those in there, that's all good. Maybe it's the fried foods, okay? Cheeseburgers. Who doesn't love a cheeseburger? You know? I'm tempted to take a bite, but I won't, okay? Oh, I don't have a power cord. Can you help me, someone? I need help. Joda's on it. We'll just keep you guys in suspense as I keep going. But then pop. We like pop. Isaac likes pop. Isaac could probably drink this whole thing before church is over, and then he'd be dancing like a little boy because he needs to use the bathroom. He wouldn't be able to go, okay? But here's the idea. You know, all of this stuff we like and we want to indulge in, but there's consequences for it. You know, what I'm getting at is, so when we look at this idea of what Jesus had to do, he took all of this nasty upon himself, and he didn't want to do that. He knew what the consequences were going to be. It was more than the pain and more than the suffering. Thank you, Joetta. Joetta's my savior. Not in a spiritual sense. That would be Jesus. Just to clarify. Thank you so much. You can just plug, there's a surge strip right there too. This is so exciting. Normally I'm up here alone. It's not gross. This is going to be so delicious. Who said that, Brody? That's right. You like all these things, don't you? Okay. I'm so sorry. You know, I had the extension cord in my truck, and then I took it out, and then I didn't put it back. And then you know what happened? I didn't bring it. We have contact? Come on. Okay. Yes. Now you know what Jesus didn't want to drink. I mean, you see that? I mean, we look at this idea of sin, and to us, sin is something that's like, oh, but it tastes so good. Yeah, it might make me a little bit fat. Yeah, maybe there's some consequences, but there's this reality that there's this whole, I can't do it. There's this whole cup of yuck. There's this whole cup of nasty. And yet what Jesus is saying in a sense in this prayer is like, Lord, if there's any possible way that I don't have to drink that to be able to save the world from the nasty, please let me not have to drink it. But he says, not my will. Lord, if that's what it takes, I will do it. I mean, what an amazing picture. You know, and then this happens. It's a three-time sequence that we find here in Matthew. Here we go. So he goes away and he comes back. He finds his disciples sleeping. We focus on that. We see that. And certainly there's some piece to that, because what we're going to find is that these disciples, they flee. They scatter. You know, even in the midst of it, they're gone. They've left Jesus. He's alone. He gets to suffer these things on his own. If they would have been maybe watchful and praying, maybe they would have stuck together. This is what he said. So he went away a second time after he found them sleeping. He said, why are you sleeping? Don't you understand? This temptation to eat this stuff is right there before you. And you guys won't really acknowledge that it's a serious thing. Sin's a serious thing. Sin's a big deal. More than something that just makes us a little bit fat around the waistline. And so he goes away and he prays, my Father, if it is not possible for this cup to be taken away unless I drink it, look at that. If it's not possible for this cup to be taken away until I have taken this and drank it. Then he says, may your will be done. I'll do what you need me to do. I will take the nasty. For the sake of the people, so no one else has to drink it, I will drink it. That's Jesus' job, not mine.
It's so gross. That's the idea of the cheese. I can see cheeseburger chunks floating.
It looks like something. I'm not going to go there. It's anyway. So look at this now. So in Matthew 26, and this is why I brought this passage in, because we see this context of what Jesus is really suffering before he even gets arrested. And it gives you this idea of where he's at, but now you're going to see, even in the midst of this, who Jesus really is. Look at these passages. They're just really mind-blowing. So it says in Matthew 26, verse 45, it says, look, okay, he's come back. This is the third time. All right, he'd gone away, he prayed three times. He came back, found his disciples sleeping every time, and you can't blame them. You know, they crossed that valley at 11 o'clock. All right, I don't know if you're like me, but I'm a bird in a cage. That light goes off, I'm out, okay? And past, you know, 8:30, I start getting sleepy. Exaggerating a little bit, but still, there's this reality. I'm not a night owl. I won't stay up all night, okay? And so here's his disciples. It's probably 1 o'clock in the morning by this time. They're probably tired. I don't blame them for falling asleep. And yet Jesus knows. He knows that they are going to be challenged. They are going to be tempted, and he wants desperately, desperately for them to be able to stand under that temptation. And so he's not only saying, what's wrong with you guys? Why are you sleeping? It's more than like, you guys have no idea what you're about ready to encounter. I know what I'm about ready to encounter. I know what you guys are going to encounter, and you're clueless. Stay awake and pray because you don't get it. And it's not a I'm against you type thing. It's like, oh, guys, if you couldn't just see what I see and know what you're about to entail, you wouldn't help but to be able to stay awake and pray because you'd be so filled with anxiety just the way I am now. He says, look, the hour has come. The Son of Man is delivered into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us go. Here comes my betrayer. And just keep in mind, this really, at this point, the disciples did not yet know that Judas, for the most part, was the betrayer. Remember, they thought he had gone away to get bread, you know, get some food for the Passover meal. Well, then they left, and they're probably scratching their head. Well, Judas never came back. I thought he was getting meal, you know, food for us. I don't know how this is going to work out. Well, here he says, here comes my betrayer. And then we flip back, and we look at it in John 18, verse 2. It says, now Judas, who betrayed him, so we have him identified. Here he comes. He knew the place because Jesus had often met there with his disciples. So Judas had gone off. He had gone and basically sold out. He got the guards. He says, I will take you to Jesus. And we see the context here as to what he says and how he sends the signal as to who this Jesus is, because a lot of these Roman rulers wouldn't have been able to identify him, perhaps because they didn't really know him. In addition to, it's at night. And so to get a good look at which one it is, they really wouldn't have been able to know. And so Matthew 26, he says, now the betrayer, who was Judas, had arranged a signal with them. The one I kiss is the man, arrest him. Going at once to Jesus, Judas said, greetings, Rabbi, and he kissed him. The betrayal. And so in John 18, it says, so Judas came to the garden, guiding a detachment of soldiers. That would have been at least 600 Roman soldiers. Here's Jesus and 11 guys, and here comes the 600 Roman soldiers. Now, catch some of this stuff. This is really cool when you kind of grasp what's going on in this contrast that you see. A detachment of Roman soldiers and some officials, get this, some officials from the chief priests and Pharisees. So you have chief priests, you have Pharisees, and you have 600 Roman soldiers. That's quite a mob, all right? That's a big group of people. And notice that both Jews and Gentiles are there. And I'm convinced that that's very intentional that John shares this, as well as some of the other Gospels that point out both Jews and Gentiles are involved in this arrest. Both are guilty. Oftentimes we say, well, the Jews are the ones guilty, and Jesus was gracious enough to let the Gentiles in. We're both guilty of it, Jews and Gentiles. We're all involved in why Christ had to suffer and die, because it's our nastiness that fills this cup. So Judas came to the garden. He's got the 600 Roman soldiers, chief priests, Pharisees. They carried, look at this, he carried torches and lanterns and weapons. Is the irony only on me that here come this mob of people carrying torches and lanterns to arrest the light of the world? You know what I mean? Here's Jesus, the light of the world, and they're bringing their own light. And likewise, they're bringing weapons to arrest who? The Prince of Peace. You see that? I don't know. I'm not saying that John was totally intentional on that, but I think that it's possible that there's an emphasis there. Why they're carrying torches, they're carrying lanterns to arrest the light of the world, they're carrying weapons to arrest the Prince of Peace. So in verse 4 then, it says, Jesus, knowing, I love this, knowing all that was going to happen to him, he went out and asked him, this is an extremely critical question. He asked him, who is it you're looking for? You know, who is it that you want? Who are you looking for? Here's a mob of people. Jesus knows who they're looking for, but he wants to hear them say it. Who are you looking for? And notice their answer. Because I think this answer is significant. It says, Jesus of Nazareth, they replied. And what, remember back in John chapter 1, I skipped a verse there. In John chapter 1, if you remember, maybe I have it after. Yes, there it is. Nope. That's back up again. Yeah, there it is. I just got the wrong chapter. It's not, envision that 8 is not there. Okay? Just block out the 8 from your mind. We're good. So John chapter 1, verse 46. Remember this, when Jesus goes out and he's calling his first disciples. Okay, he said, come follow me, to several of them. Well, in this one case, here you have Nathanael and you have Philip. And so Philip goes up to Nathanael and says, basically, come and see, we've met the Messiah. And this is Nathanael's response. Nazareth, because he found out that Jesus came from Nazareth. Nazareth, can anything good come from there? And, and Philip said, well, come and see. And that brings us to what we're looking at. So they said, Jesus of Nazareth, who we're looking for. In other words, we're looking for this lowly peasant person. Nobody significant. We're just looking for this insignificant man. He comes from Nazareth. His name happens to be Jesus. That's who we're here to arrest. Oh, get this. This blows your mind. Jesus says, I am he. And as Judas the traitor was standing there with them, and when Jesus said, I am he, they drew back and they fell to the ground. That wasn't an accident. They're saying, we're looking for a lowly man from Nazareth. Not important. Not significant. Just a little, kind of a peasant person. And once we arrest him, we'll be out of your way. Jesus' response, they had no idea what they were looking for. Jesus' response is basically, I'm God. I am the Almighty. And when he says, I am, they all fall over. I mean, demonstrating, I mean, this is just mind-blowing. So there, here they are, this mob of people coming against one man, and they're saying, Jesus says, who are you looking for? We're looking for just a little peasant person. No, no one big. I am the Lord. Demonstrating fully his power, who he is. I mean, talk about who's in control. 600 plus men or Jesus? Jesus is 100% totally in control of the situation. He just knocked all of them over, and yet he still stands there, and he asks again, who is it you're looking for? Who is it that you want? I'm guessing that the tone might have been a little bit different this time, but they said the same thing. Maybe a little bit of fear. What's he going to do to us now? Jesus of Nazareth, they said. And once again, Jesus answered, I told you, I am he. What's amazing, you think about this idea of Moses and that burning bush, that same I am that made that bush burn is the same I am that spoke I am that knocked all 600 plus of these men over. And he says, I told you that I am he. If you're looking for me, let these men go. And this is mind-blowing too, really, when you grasp it. He says, this happened so that the words he had spoken would be fulfilled. Do you understand what that's saying? In other words, what it's saying is, this happened so that Jesus' words would be fulfilled. Meaning Jesus' words are now, in a sense, scripture because he said them, and they thus are a prophecy should be fulfilled. You know, I mean, basically, it's saying Jesus' message, who he is, who he is from, his words are prophetic, and he is fulfilling, in a sense, his own scripture. That's pretty crazy. He says, I have not lost one of those that you gave me. That's the words that's going to be fulfilled right here. And we look back, we see it in John chapter 6. And this is the will of him who sent me, that I shall lose none of those he has given to me, but raise them up in the last day. And then we saw it in John chapter 17 in that prayer. He says, while I was with them, I protected them and kept them safe by that name that you gave me. None has been lost except the one that was doomed to destruction. That's the betrayer we just saw, so that scripture would be fulfilled. It's just crazy as to who Jesus is. He's not only saying, I'm God, my word is scripture. It will be fulfilled just as I said that it would be. And so then we see in John chapter 18, verse 10. So Simon Peter steps up. We already heard about Simon Peter. We'll talk about more of him in a couple of weeks here yet too. Simon Peter, good old Simon, steps up. He's the one that said, I will never, even if all fall away, I will never fall. Jesus, I got your back. And so these people come to arrest him. Simon Peter steps up. He pulls out a sword and he drew it and he struck the high priest's servant, cutting off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. It tells us one of three things with Simon Peter.
either he was left-handed, okay, because the right ear of the man was cut off, or he's happened to be standing behind him, so he's a coward and trying to attack the guy from the back, or he's just a really bad shot. And then we come to John chapter 18, verse 11. And Jesus commanded Peter, put away your sword. You know, and we see it in the Matthew account where Jesus will actually say, what am I trying to do here? Lead a rebellion? Peter, you don't understand what's going on here. And how he ends this whole sequence is just fabulous. In verse 52, it says this, Peter, put away your sword. For all who draw the sword will die by the sword. Do you think that I cannot call? I love this. Talk about control. This is what Jesus says to all who are standing there, including Peter, in the midst of this, after he has said, I am, do you think I cannot call on my Father and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels? You think they have an army with 600 soldiers? They got nothing. I have the sovereignty. I have the control. I could diminish this just like that. Didn't you see me? I knocked him over with my words. But how then would the scriptures be fulfilled that say that it must happen this way, that I must drink the cup? At that time, Jesus said to the crowd, Am I leading a rebellion that you have come out with swords and clubs to capture me? Every day I sat in the temple. In other words, these people could have arrested him sooner. You know, and ironically, some of these chief priests and the servants, they are some of the same ones that were there in John chapter 7 that went up to Jesus to arrest him, and they came back to the Pharisees, and the Pharisees said, why haven't you arrested him? And their answer was what? Well, no one ever spoke like this guy before. They had their chance, and they didn't do it. I sat at the temple courts teaching, and you did not arrest me. But this has all taken place that the writings of the prophet might be fulfilled. And then it says, then all the disciples deserted him and fled. And this is how we wrap it up here. And it says, Jesus commanded Peter, put away your sword. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me? He says, shall I not take all that nasty that no one else can deal with? I'm the only one that can deal with it. No one else wants to touch it. And even if they wanted to touch it, they couldn't deal with all that nasty that's in that cup. That's my job to drink it, even if I don't want to. And it brings us to this idea and this kind of concluding point. We have to ask ourselves maybe a couple of questions. Number one is, who's really in control? You know, we live our lives and oftentimes it's like, well, I want to control this. And that's human nature, I think, is a big part of it. But I think we all experience moments of chaos. You know, our lives honestly sometimes feel like they're totally upside down. You know, it's fascinating, and I don't know if this is, you know, an attack of the enemy or just the Lord saying to me, it's like, okay, you're talking about control, let's see how you do with this reality. But last night, my computer quit working. It's bad timing when you have your sermon on the computer and you have your PowerPoint on the computer. And to have it happen, you know, I mean, it was late last night, about 11, well, midnight, when I learned that my computer wasn't working. That's a problem. So then I went to non-sleep, and when I got up from non-sleep, then I had to still work on some of this stuff. But in the midst of it, I really sensed the Lord saying, okay, it's a little bit chaotic right now, isn't it? But it's okay. You looked at the word. Let me do my work with my word. All you have to do is share it. You know? So what's the chaos? I know. I could pinpoint several of you that we've been in life together, and I know you're experiencing chaos here. I know you're experiencing chaos here. And in the midst of that, we can still look and be confident. It's like, okay, I don't know how to deal with the chaos, but from what I read here, God does. And so I'm going to be okay with his control because he sure seemed to be in control. And I put it this way. If Jesus can be in control in the midst of his chaos, which was crazier than you'll ever experience, do you think he can handle yours? I think so. And that's one thing. So let's wrestle with that. Who's in control? But the other idea is, who are you looking for? Are you looking for a Jesus that you can, in a sense, put in a box, control, manipulate? This is who my Jesus should be. This is who I want this Jesus to be. I want this Jesus to be someone who says that I'm doing all the right things, even though I know that I'm not. I want this Jesus to be someone that I can kind of pet me and say, you're so good. And then I think he does that. He certainly says that he loves us, but he doesn't accept all the sin all the things that we do. I mean, that's not part of what he wants. He wants for us to be sanctified, to become more like him. And so that's where we have to say, okay, Jesus, if you are who you say you are, then I guess I'm the one that needs to change. And so you have to ask yourself, who are you looking for? Maybe you're not looking for Jesus at all. Maybe you're looking for Jesus to be this person that's got to fit into this mold. But the reality of it is, he's not in any mold that we can create for him. He's bigger than any mold that we would ever be able to create for him. He is sovereign, and he is good. You look at the way he has loved his disciples, the way he has prayed for his disciples the last few weeks, the way he is in the midst of the control, and even in the midst of that, he willingly is able and willing to take all that you struggle with, all those sins that you don't want to tell anyone, all those sins that people know about and you can't get a handle on. He's willing to take it and drink it, because that's the only way that you could have freedom from it. So who are you looking for? I'm going to invite Kevin and the worship team up. And we're gonna sing. I want you to reflect on those things. Reflect on this reality. Who is in control? And reflect on this truth then of who you're looking for. Don't answer just passively saying, oh, this is who I know I'm supposed to be looking for. Answer it honestly. Wrestle with that reality. What is it? Who is it that you're looking for? And then identify, who is this Jesus? And open yourself up to say, I want whatever it is that you have for me.